Hi, this is Tony Tolato, and today on Sci-Fi Talk, one of the best makeup artists in the business today, Donald Moad, who's been on this podcast several times. Lately, he's worked on Dune Part 1 and also Dune Part 2 and the acclaimed film The Covenant. And this is Sci-Fi Talk, the podcast on how sci-fi, fantasy, horror, and comics help us explore our humanity. And we talk about Tron Ares from where the film is shooting in Vancouver. Couldn't say too much, but we do talk about his craft, makeup, and all the various aspects of it. Interesting conversation. First of all, congratulations on Dune 2 and the Saturn Award for The Covenant. Well deserved. Some great work on both those projects.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, fifth anniversary. I think somebody said today is 5 years to the day since we started Dune.
Wow.
Yeah, it's 5 years. And thank you about The Covenant, because I think it's a film that I guess people saw once it went on to, again, TV or Amazon and Prime and everything. But I think everybody's really surprised. You know, so many of us talk about movies these days and how few of them are being made. So when we get to make a film, a proper film rather than a TV film, we're so happy. We're just so see it and go to the movies.
Yeah. One last thing about Dune, folks, if you haven't seen it in IMAX like I did this previous weekend, you should. It looks fabulous. And the sound is sensational. You got to do it. This one is, I was actually surprised that they were going to make another Tron, because it's been a few years since the last one came out.
Right.
How did you get involved?
You know, it's something we'll have to wait till next year. But all I can really say is I'm very excited about it, because it's not something I knew a lot about when I got a call pre-strike. So for those listening who were not, you know, well, who everybody's heard about the strike by now, but pre-Writers Guild of America and SAG after strike last summer, I was working in Los Angeles and I did get a call about, you know, a kind of a revision, remounting of Tron by the same people who had done the last one with new directors. And I was really interested in it visually. I thought it would be very interesting and a great creative team. And Jared Leto as the lead, who I've worked with before. And I found it very exciting and interesting. So here we are, we're shooting and we're halfway through in Vancouver. And it looks sensational. And I guess I'm probably only allowed to say that we have an incredible cast led by Jared Leto and Evan Peters and Jodie Turner-Smith and Greta Lee and some incredible music. Jeff Cronenworth is shooting it. I mean, Joachim Rauner directing it. It's kind of incredible. And it's a departure for me to work on something like this. And you know what? I kind of love it.
There is more Sci-Fi Talk, so stay tuned.
As we saw in the last movie, one of the characters from the grid, which is the virtual world, made it to our world. So I'm not giving anything away that's part of what this is about, too, is that somebody comes over from the other side to here. So that's interesting. I would think makeup-wise... because some of the characters are like digital versions of people. That must be a little challenging, to say the least.
I can't really say very much other than I think just we'll talk again next year.
Yeah.
I think it's a departure. You know, I think it looks amazing. You know, sometimes all I can say is less is more. It doesn't have to be. Sometimes people have these imagined ideas, but I think our producers and creative people have creatively where I think it needs to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I remember seeing the original in 1982. I went to the movies. That was a great summer for movies, too, as a matter of fact. But I remember seeing it. And then the sequel, I really liked how they updated it. And having Jeff Bridges back, I thought that was great.
Right.
And Bruce
right.
Boxleitner too, for that matter. So
yeah, there you go. Yeah, ahead of its time. So,
yeah.
You know, I think it's just people, well, we'll see. I think people are very excited about it. And I love, I guess the last thing I'll say really about this movie is I love that it's a cast of people who are, you know, more mature, older, it's very exciting to see that and that people are interested in the cast. It's not 12. You have people in their 30s and 40s and 50s. And nice. I think that's kind of nice.
Yeah, yeah. Jared is a tremendous talent. So great. He can carry anything far as I'm concerned. So he's going to be
great. He can. He really can.
So I want to ask you about something. I just remember seeing an older film recently and, you know, the use of fake blood in those days. And it was like, boy, that looks a little too watery. Just in your career, how has that evolved? I guess it used to be Cairo syrup, but is it different now?
Well, it's interesting you ask that because it's changed. You know, some films now have become very safe. You know, I know that certain studios, Marvel and Disney, are very nervous about blood and R ratings and things, and that it has to be used sparingly and as it should. You know, I think there's an artful way to work with blood. I'm very particular about it. I think the blood of the old days sometimes was a bit too syrupy, maybe, or the colors have changed. You know, obviously film stock and now we're in the digital age, and sometimes the film back in film stock. Some people think it's too watery, some think too syrupy, some think too, you know, everyone's a critic now and everyone's an expert. I think that the bloods have changed sometimes because the chemicals have changed in the bloods that we use. They used to use PhotoFlow. To make it simple, I do think that a lot of films have also added digital blood effects, which I'm not crazy about. Sometimes the marriage of the two is great, where you'll have an effect where you get blood that is added in to complete the effect. So it's in unison and it works really well. And other times where it's just a blood effect, like earlier on that film 300, you're very aware it's digital and it looks rather
digital.
Having said that, that doesn't always, it's a bad thing, right? The digital blood.
Yeah.
But I do think I would rather see a tiny bit of blood. I've always followed the rule of thumb that if I saw tiny, tiny little bit of blood coming from the head or from the ear, I know that person's in trouble.
Yeah, we saw it. We saw it recently. So,
right.
Yeah.
And when we see a lot of blood, superficial, you know, there are wounds that people kind of go in. And I've had that happen myself where I've created wounds on people and go, oh my God. And people, you know, even EMTs turn up at scenes of accidents and they have to distinguish, is that blood third party, second party? Is that from a shooting? Is it superficial? And people think, oh, that's too much blood. Well, no, it's not actually from a head wound. You know, cut your hand. Have you ever done that doing the dishes? I mean, you cut your hand. You think, my God, I'm losing my arm.
Yes.
But sometimes I think the audiences just need to see some blood. And I've said that to Disney on a few projects. You just need a little bit to sell it. A lot can make it go suddenly be movie. So it's very sparingly used and judicious in how your director wants to use it. And other films like Tarantino, who I actually really admire, I think sometimes it's kind of a visual storytelling what he does with blood. And it's kind of funny in its own way and not to be taken too seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it can certainly make the jump from almost comical in some movies that works. It's an art. It's like any good makeup to do it the right way. It just doesn't take away from what's going on screen.
That's right. That's right.
Then you know you hit it. You know, you really hit it.
Yeah. And the right blood, I think, for the piece, I've struggled sometimes where I learned something once actually from a DP. Sean Babbitt taught me something very important once about kind of blood and wounds for a sequence that was, is that really for a leading man or is that for the real thing? Because there's also two ways of doing it. And I really learned something from him because I was getting into the world, we call it the sort of Tom Cruise designer blood. And I was maybe getting into that when I was doing a little few too many films with action stars, not naming names. But right. I owe Sean Babbitt a great debt of thanks, because I realized one day, I went, oh, he's right. Because I saw the actor coming and I went, I know what he means. It's kind of a designer at this point. Mm-hmm. And I changed it. I really decided to go back to the basics and shift it from looking very 007, shall we say. And I'm not referring to that particular person at all, but as a reference point, because you always did on action films, you made the blood and wounds make the actor look attractive whilst being beat up.
Yes, that's
this
right.
Time, you know? Yeah. You had to make them, you know, you always did the dirt while you shaded them and you had the sweat and the blood and they still looked like the leading lady would kiss them and not like, oh. And he taught me that. And so I've learned a great lesson. And now I use that in films, that are we really going for the real thing?
What about aging somebody? The great Dick Smith, I think, used old age stipple. Is that something to use?
Yeah, I mean, we still do it. It's really funny. I love that you're asking these questions, because we're seeing fewer and fewer people around anymore. I mean, Dick Smith, the Godfather.
You know, my God.
I mean, I think he had as much impact on filmmaking as any great director or cinematographer, if you really get down to it.
Oh, yeah.
But then, you know, we had other people as well. I mean, you've got, Stan Winston and Greg Canham and other people more of late, you know. Matthew Mungall made a great stipple aging, which he's retired now, but he really formulated his own Matthew Mungall stipple, and we still use it. It's in fact, I've used it more recently, and it's a very effective. A lot of the newer makeup artists are not familiar with how to do aging, stipple aging. They don't learn it, because a lot of the people are now, everything's got to be a prosthetic piece. And it's unfortunate, you know, although, yes, it's great to know how to do these prosthetic works and have teams of amazing prosthetic artists, but not everything can be done that way. Not every film has a budget to allow you to bring in an amazing team of prosthetics artists, or to sketch and Photoshop and 3D print and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes you're making a smaller film that has $8 million. And you can't have 10 makeup people. You cannot have a 3-hour makeup. You have 1-hour makeup. You don't have a Bradley Cooper or a Harrison Ford or a Daniel Craig. You've got a guy most people have never heard of. So how are you going to do this? Stipple aging is a fabulous alternative to, say, take a guy from 50 to 70. It's a great way to work. Add some facial hair. Play around with the hair, maybe pull the hairline back and do some great work with your costume designer. And voila, you create some aging. Think of Max von Sydow, how young he was in The Exorcist, and one of the greatest actors ever.
Oh my
God. But how Dick Smith was able to take him as a young man and make him look into his 70s. People would not even think of doing that today. And yet we still do. I mean, I think if you've got a performance that's maybe, I don't know, I've done it on jobs where we did it with Dave Bautista in Blade Runner, for example.
Yes.
Some people would say, Donald, you're wrong. You should do it with pieces. I am so pro prosthetic. I'm so pro practical and bring in the right people. But sometimes it's wrong. Sometimes you don't have the time or the money or the budget. And, you know, that's an ideal situation to do that. So yeah. I'm really glad you brought that up. And there's some wonderful people still working that we do like to practice and work with it and combine different makeup techniques.
Yeah, I like stipple because it looks very natural. Some appliances look too unnatural to me.
Yeah.
I think Brando in The Godfather was another great example. And they even built a denture for him to wear to puff out his cheeks and everything like somebody at that age would have. So it was extremely realistic. And of course, he was much younger than that when he did the film. So
One thing, Tony, you bring up is interesting to me, because I was just speaking you know, with my great friends, the Deacon Roger and James, and of course, Greg Fraser, is that there's very, I think it's important for people listening to know that we don't test makeups the way we used to. It's really, it's very disheartening and frustrating and not like we did. I mean, back in the day, and I'm not talking, I'm not 100, but the way we used to test makeup and hair and clothes and costumes, we used to spend a couple of days, you know, at least testing all of these things. Now we're down to, on most projects, I'm not kidding, on most projects, you'll find, you'll get your call sheet and go, you'll beg the first AD, can we get a second day maybe? Because I'm looking at this call sheet and we're testing what? Everything in one day.
There is more sci-fi talk, so stay tuned.
Which includes prop photo stills, all the costumes, et cetera, et cetera. And you get down to saying, but what about I need to test some aging makeup on Jane Doe, John Doe, this one, that one. What about doing this? And it's not happening. And we never test in the right light. And you've come down to maybe, I don't know, one day from 3 days and the actor's availability. And I think the business has changed so much that instead of just being angry or bitter, you sort of go, wow, I'm really in a, we have to be better, faster, more resourceful. And you tend to sit and go on podcasts like this and then vent and say, I'm not angry. I just would love to know, when did it change? And we ask colleagues all the time, when did it change? When did actors become so unavailable? When did studios decide, they can figure it out. They're good. But we used to test a lot more to figure out, you know. So that's kind of the world we're living in now, is often you get your makeup test on the first day of shooting.
I think part of it is that they have reduced the shooting schedules to save money and to get the product out quicker.
Of course.
So that's part of it. It's like, we need this now. And it's just like the days of experimentation and or like you said, a day. I mean, that's hardly enough to even scratch the surface sometimes.
That's right. So we're doing, you know, often. So it's really a new, we're in a new world where you have to have a bigger team. You have to get the best of the best. You spend more because you're getting things last minute. But, you know, it's just good for people to know that's what it is now, you know.
Yeah. Another thing is hair. That's changed a lot since I've been watching movies. Okay. What do you use human hair, or it used to be horse hair was very popular.
You mean for the wigs and things?
Yeah, wigs and, you know, mustaches and all, and goatees.
Well, mustaches and beards and things are made from yak hair. Rarely made from human hair because it would actually doesn't really work in human hair. Wigs, as in a head of hair, are the best ones. Custom ones are made with human hair. Typically, when you're doing things like, photo doubles, you want your photo doubles, your best wigs, the money shots on your, obviously your actors, your photo doubles, stunt doubles, you want human hair. Which is very expensive. It's delicate because the hair, typically you're getting hair from Eastern Europe and Asia. And it's a delicate subject right now because of the countries it comes from. So that's another topic. But the costs are very expensive. And then they come through, it's so bizarre to even say, from brokers. Can you believe it? It's like we're in 2024 and people broker hair.
That's amazing.
It sounds like some fable of, you know, I don't know what, in folklore. So that's what happens there. Now, facial hair, beautiful facial hair will be made, you know, it's made in the UK, often a little bit in North America. The best facial hair, in my opinion, is still made through Europe and particularly in the UK because they do. And this is, again, for listeners, it's not because they're better. It's because they do more period films. Therefore, if you do it more, you become, practice makes perfect. So if you're doing a weekly BBC, Channel 4, the type of Merchant Ivory films of the past, you have the culture of making lots of period films. In America, we didn't do as many of those period films. And period to us in America tends to be Civil War. The facial hair is not as challenging. And we had fewer people doing it. And it could be more handmade. We had lots of guys, the old Hollywood makeup guys like Mike Germain and Leonard Engelman. They were masters at that. The big bushy beards and the, you know.
Yeah.
But as far as more refined and then the various periods. So we didn't have the big rentals. Mm-hmm. And then there are good wig makers, again, in LA and New York, but fewer. We have one or two in LA, one or two in New York, but it wasn't a culture of it. Like Paul Huntley had died a few years ago. He was 90. I mean, he had done every Broadway production that you could think of, but there were fewer people. So I would say for facial hair, yak hair is predominantly used for because it curls, you can perm it, and it looks right. The good news is young people are learning that craft again. And we're hoping every once in a while when I see somebody younger or people who may not be as mobile, people who may not be someone who could stand on a set all day doing makeup or hair, people who might have mobility issues or some handicapped issues, I go, you know, what about going into wig making? What about we get you trained up with one of the great wig makers, facial hair makers based in New York or LA or London or Bristol? And that's my mission for the next few years, is to try to get people who may be able to divert some of that energy into something that they could do within the film and television industry.
That's great to give back. I think it's wonderful.
But also people who just physically, there are people who just can't do the physical work of what we do, but would love to be engaged and be creative in a way that, you know, people who sort of do fine needlepoint or needlework, you could do, because making wigs is precision. It's precision work. And you need glasses by, you know, the time you've done it for a few years. Is maybe that's a great way to, we can start to get people creative who can't be out on the floor.
Yeah, yeah. I see in that great IMDb that you're going to be working on a series, Presumed Innocent.
Coming in June.
Yeah. So what's it like to go from a feature to a series? Because obviously the deadlines are a little tight, to say the least.
Well, I was so very fortunate because right before the strike, that came up. That presented itself with, you know, my friend, the one and only, the really wonderful Jake Gyllenhaal, called me up. I was somewhere in the desert being sick with, I don't know, I thought it was Ebola, but it wasn't. It was E. coli. And he said to me, oh, you like that actress, Ruth Negga, and there's this one and that one, and my brother-in-law, Peter Sarsgaard, and we're all in this, and everybody deciding, you know what, movies, there's a problem. We've got to do some TV. And I talked to Anne Sawitsky, Norwegian director, and I loved her. And everybody was in it. And I've only ever done, apart from Moon Knight, a few with great Oscar Isaac. And I thought, you know what? I'm in for this. It was 8 episodes, I think, all in Los Angeles. The last show at the Warner Brothers Ranch before they knocked it down, sadly.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, knocked down, Bewitched, all those shows.
Oh, my God, I know.
So, there I was, and you know what? I had a very nice time. Some challenging things, believe it or not, you know, because I am a TV snob. I've said it before. I'll say it again. I started in TV. I learned my craft. I learned to be quick and fast and efficient and how to break down a script. But it was different because we went into TV to get to do movies, not the other way around. And now all the TV people coming into movies, there's some problems, I've got to say. Now that I'm the older guy looking at them, I go, come on, what did you learn? What did you learn here? Not a lot. You're supposed to get proficient. And so when I went into TV again, I was surprised at how little people had learned to be proficient and to be filmmakers. considering the budgets are so much better than they used to be, considering the talent they had around them. Oscar nominees, Ruth Negga, Jake Gyllenhaal, actors like that, where everybody was like, huh, it's a new world, new generation. But then we had these wonderful directors. We had 8 episodes. You drive to work, park the car. Maybe it's too easy. I don't know. 8 episodes there in LA. Strike happens. People were pretty much, you know, had their insurance. So it was different times.
Yeah. And
I felt like something has changed in this business, like TV, the culture. Something's ruined something. I don't know what. But now I sound like an old person. And
No, I think it's a valid point. I really
but, right. So, but it was a great, and I would do it again in a heartbeat. And so I do know there's something's different. Recently, my great friend Howard Berger. He's incredible. I mean, not only the governor of our makeup and hair branch at the Academy, but also the vice president of the Academy. I did say something. He said, "Give us a quote or something." I can't remember what it was for, maybe the book but I did say to him that TV, if you go into it, you've got to make the best of it. And if you don't, you won't be good in movies. And I really believe it. So I made the best of that show. And I would love to do more television. I see it. I watch things like Mare of Easttown and, you know, obviously The Crown and that new one, oh my God, the one with Gary Oldman, Fools and Horton.
Oh yeah, yes. I know the one you mean. And boy, his look is amazing.
And you know, there's great looks happening and there's people doing incredible work. And I think it's great, but we just have to retrain people and kind of get tough again, right?
Yep.
Yeah, it was very enjoyable, as was Moon Knight. Moon Knight, I took it way too seriously. I thought I was really coming up with characters and I loved doing that look for Oscar Isaac. And, you know, I actually got emails. You know, I went to a university, a college in the UK, and a student who has, they call it DID, which is another form. And I don't want to use the incorrect medical terms of diagnoses, but it is a form of schizophrenia. The teacher, professor of that course wrote to me and said, could I forward you something? And I said, yes, of course. And it was from a student who is treated for DID. And that person said, thank you for portraying the way you made the person look was so good because I suffer from that. I'm treated for that.
Wow.
And I was so moved by it. And I told Oscar Isaac, I said, I'm so glad we did you that way because people don't understand the shift in character and how immediate when there's that's happening, the pallor change, the sweat, the nausea, of what happens when a personality change is happening.
Yeah, he was terrific in it. And if hopefully Marvel will revisit that character again, I'd love to see Moon Knight in the Avengers too. So we'll see.
Right, yeah.
You know, he belongs there, so yeah.
A movie maybe, right?
Yeah, movie. Back on TV would be cool. But you know, it's a very strange time we're in right now with streaming, and the strike really hurt them a lot. So, you know, they're trying to get back on their feet. So we'll see what happens.
That's right.
So thank you so much for taking time out from Tron.
My pleasure. And, always a pleasure to speak with you. Yeah.
Ditto.
We're going through so many changes. Like you said, the strike, I think recovering it's, and we're still not really through it. We're feeling it. COVID, I think from a crew perspective, we really feel it a lot. We feel like we took a hit. We're a bit unsung, I think the crew really feel like we took a tremendous hit on behalf of the actors and writers, and we're not properly acknowledged. So I feel that as we came back, we also felt like, but we're the ones that really took the hit and our insurance. So we have a lot of people are really suffering, really, really suffering.
Yeah.
You know, again, I mean, contrary to what people believe, our insurance is based on how many hours we work. It's not based on a number. So what happened to us is for the people that care is a lot of synthetic indignation because We were not on strike. We have a no strike clause, many people in our union. So we respected and supported, but we didn't have anybody able to raise money for us. A couple of performers in a couple of shows were like Abbott Elementary. There were two or three actors that spoke really positively for us, but most people were raising money for them, which is their duty, I guess. But we don't have anyone making $10 million a paycheck that was supporting our insurance. And so many of our members lost their insurance and lost their homes and eviction. And no, so we don't hear that. So I just wanted to say that so that that goes out there.
Absolutely.
IATSE members lost a lot.
Wow.
And we supported SAG-AFTRA and EA. Wow. And we really paid a price to support them.
Wow. That is such a shame because, boy, the work that you do and crews that work with you to make these characters come to life, and then it's the actor's job, and hopefully the script is there too, but without proper makeup, I mean,
well, it's everything. It's like we get there, you know, everyone gets everybody where they need to be.
Yep.
And so it was really, so I'm feel very fortunate to be back here working, and you know, we've got a few more weeks to go.
All right, fantastic.
Thanks so much for having
my pleasure, and best of luck with the rest of the movie. And we'll talk about this about a year.
June, I think it's 20. I'll get the date for you, but it's very exciting. 2025.
Fantastic.
And Jared Leto, amazing.
Oh, yeah. I'm not surprised there. All right. You take care, sir. Always a pleasure.
Tron: Ares, as we talked about, is out in 2025. Dune Part 1 is now available, and Dune Part 2 will soon to follow on Max. The Covenant is available wherever you get your movies.
Customizable podcast playlists, exclusive videos, special episodes like the Mix 100 podcasts selected by listener downloads. All this and more at Sci-Fi Talk Plus. And now with 1,000 episodes, uncut, and a special offer for free lifetime access now available until May 1st. Click on the link in the show notes. No anonymous signups are allowed.
Thanks so much for listening. This is Tony Tolato. Until next time.